You did your time, you wore the uniform, you followed the mission, but now you're standing at the edge of the civilian world, wondering if the chaos behind you ever really ended, or maybe just changed names. Maybe you thought about contracting. Maybe you've heard the rumors, big money, wild stories, no rules. But what's the real price of trading a uniform for a paycheck and a rifle? Now picture this, you're rolling through Baghdad in the suburban, no clear rules of engagement, no backup. And the only reason you're even there is because a buddy vouched for you. That was Morgan Lorette's World with Blackwater. Today's episode isn't about glorifying war or tearing it down. It's telling the truth from the ground level. The kind of truth that gets left out of the press briefings and bestseller bios. From an Army intel officer to private military contractor, Morgan's story cuts through the noise with raw, unfiltered honesty and just enough dark humor to keep it real. But before we dive into this episode, make sure you're subscribed to the email newsletter at driveonpodcast.com/subscribe. You'll get my five favorite episodes sent straight to your inbox. No fluff, just the best insights to help you drive on. I also want to take a moment to raise awareness for something deeply important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians impacted by the Global War on Terrorism. This memorial serves as both a tribute to those who served and a way to ensure their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. If you want to learn more or find out how you can support the mission, visit GWATMemorialFoundation.org. Now, let's get into today's episode. Morgan, welcome to the show. I'm really glad to have you here to talk about your experiences and your insights, but I've been looking forward to this conversation.
No, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. I guess to start with, let's talk a little bit about your background from your time in the Army and how you kind of transitioned into the private contracting role.
Yeah, so, I mean, the first thing to know is that I've never had a plan. I still don't. But in 1999, before all these wars kicked off, I was in small town USA. The recruiters were lining up, licking their lips, you know, poor white trash kid. They were like, this guy will go in. And they were right. So my grandfather looked at me and was like, he's a World War II vet, Army. And he goes, if you're going to go in the military, join the Air Force. They have better food. Literally the only thing the only thought I put into that is better food. Yeah. So I joined the Air National Guard right out of high school, December 1999. And then everything was going great. I was going to do all those sweet benefits, go to college. Next thing I know, Twin Towers fall down. I'm activated for 2 years. Went to, first pump was to Oman, and then I went to Jordan, and then Kuwait, and then Iraq during the ground offensive. So that was my enlisted time. Made it to E5. My buddy who was in the Air National Guard with me was like, dude, we should go work for Blackwater. This was 04. This was right after those guys got hanged in Fallujah. 04. Oh, okay. So nobody even knew what Blackwater was until that happened. And I was like, dude, good luck. You're going to have a great time. And he's like, oh, no, I'll put in a good word for you. So he did. He went over to Moyock, North Carolina, said, hey, call my buddy. I got a call the next day. And they said, you want to work for Blackwater? Literally, that's the only way I got in. Some guy talked to some guy and vouched for me. There was no, like, resume. There's no LinkedIn. He just kind of vouched for everybody. So I worked for Blackwater for a year and a half, half of 04, all of 05. And then after that, came home. The entire economy crashed while I was overseas, which I had no idea about. So I joined the Army National, or not the Army National Guard, the Army ROTC up at Northern Arizona University. And I wanted to fly helicopters because I had flown in them when I was in Iraq. Thought it was really cool. And then they said, that is a 6-year contract, and that doesn't count your training time of a year and a half. So 7.5 years. And I said, I'm not going to like the Army that much. Screw that. So I went back into the Army as an intel officer. They sent me back to Iraq, literally the same place as I was working for Blackwater, but for way less money. And that's how you know God's got a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And I did that after I got done with 3.5 years, I ended up going to Boston, got my graduate degree from Tufts University, which has been in the news, you know, if they're looking for deporting people. Tufts University is apparently a nice place to go. And then now I'm just working for the man.
I see that. Yeah. And I see your book on the side here for the listeners who are not watching this on, you know, YouTube or wherever we end up putting this. I got your book there, Guns, Girls, and Greed. And that's a interesting title. And I kind of want to get into that book a little bit. I know it talks about the world of Blackwater and some of the things that you guys did there. But before we get into that, I thought it was an interesting series of events that you went through in your career, you know, starting off, you know, enlisted, getting into Blackwater, and then getting back into the military. You know, usually from the people that I've known that have gone into contracting, once they get the taste of the money that comes from the contracting, they don't want to look back at the military. But you did look back, and you came back and you know, did a additional tour, you know, in the military. So what drove you to get out of Blackwater and go back into the military?
You know, I looked at my time contracting with Blackwater as a stepping stone, right? It was a job. You know, a lot of people want to conflate their time with Blackwater with their time in the military and talk about it like it's combined. It's not. For me, it was always just a cash grab, right? Mm-hmm. So I knew that it wasn't sustainable. I didn't want to do it for the next 10, 15 years. I wanted to go over there, make my money, and then go and have like a real normal human life, whatever that looked like. I had no idea what that looked like. And when I got back home, I started getting my college degree. Now, anybody that's ever transitioned out of the military, or if you're getting ready to, go use your post 9/11 GI Bill. Hmm. Go to college. Get a degree in something besides criminal justice. That's what I got mine in. I can tell you right now, if you want to be a cop, go criminal justice. If you don't want to be a cop, don't go criminal justice. I went criminal justice. I didn't want to be a cop. So it really, getting your degree, you got to get something marketable, business, engineering, you know, something along those lines. If you want to teach, go teach. But with a criminal justice degree, I didn't know what the heck I was going to do. So I just thought, well, what's my next adventure? And my next adventure was, let's go fly helicopters, was the initial plan. But it was a, I had to eat a lot of crow when I went back in the military. You know, you go from being the Blackwater guy that can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, making as much money as he literally as I wanted, right? I could jump on a contract, to going in as a second lieutenant and having everybody think that, you know, I'd never served a day of my life. And I was like, oh, geez, it was a tough transition. I'm not going to lie to you, but, yeah. Really, and I think this is something else for veterans getting out. Sometimes you got to eat the frog, right? Like, it sucks. You went and you were in charge of 10 to 15, 30 people. And then you go into corporate America and you're in charge of one or two or nobody. And at the end of the day, like, does it really matter? Because I think a lot of people get caught up in their ego. Whereas I know I've always been, you know, the dumb white trash kid from Cottonwood, Arizona, and I'm willing to start at the bottom regardless. So I think that's really helped me out quite a bit as I've trudged through this thing called life.
Yeah. And I think having, I don't know if it's, you know, humility or what it is that you might need to say, hey, you know what? I'm okay with starting from a lower position maybe than I was in the military. You know, there, a lot of times we have officers who are, you know, colonels and, you know, whatever, and they're getting out thinking that they're going to be running the show wherever they go, and they may not be. They may have, you know, a lot more higher-ups to report to than they might be used to, and that type of thing, you kind of have to just be okay with, in some cases, you know, and just kind of know that you might have to work your way back up the ladder, because, you know, the military experience, while it's great and people do look for that in the civilian world, it's doesn't always equate to, you know, their civilian world job experience. So, you know, yeah, you're right. I think you might have to just be open to that possibility anyways. You know, getting back to your book, though, Guns, Girls, and Greed, definitely an interesting title. Tell us a little bit about the book and, you know, what you put in there, some of the highlights.
Yeah, speaking of officers, those are the ones that always write books. And, dude, I can't stand most books by officers. Because most officers, and look, I'll admit it because I got out as a captain, you're not doing the job. You're doing the admin for the people that are doing the jobs. And I love to read books about the guy that was on the ground, whether it's, you know, the guy going through college or the guy that like just had a kid. But really, there's a surfeit of books out there that talk about the war and all the strategy and all the other stuff where people pat themselves on the back. Mine's the exact opposite. Mine is literally just saying, this is our job. This is what we did. This is how we did it. And it's a real ground perspective of war. So it starts off with literally the first chapter starts off with one of the times I ended up shooting at a car in Baghdad. And what does it feel like to go from safe to fire? And then you take that shot. And what does that feel like? And really trying to put people into that position of where I was as a 23-year-old, you know, young adult. So it was really to try to get people to that ground level. And it's also because every time I heard something about Blackwater, I was like, none of this stuff happened to the people on the ground, right? Like Eric Prince has a book and he talks about how we were all patriots and we saved Iraq. And then you have Jeremy Scahill that says we were all the worst people on the planet. The truth is in the middle and the truth is on the ground. And that's really what I wanted to write. And it's everything from those mundane, boring conversations. Somebody told me it's like the perfect E4 Mafia book, right? Where you're sitting there in a Humvee and you're bored and you start coming up with these conversations like, okay, so for $73 and a piece of chewed bubble gum, would you go over there and show your ass to those people? And it's like, and then you debate that for 45 minutes because that's what you do. Most of war, 99% is boredom. And it's just punctuated by this pure adrenaline. And you chase that adrenaline. And what does that feel like from the ground perspective? So I call it the Guns, Girls, and Greed because that's what we talked about, right? We talked about our guns. We talked about our girls, whether they were back at home or we were going to go and purchase them for 10 to 15 minutes on the way home. And then the other thing is always like how much money we were making. Cause all of us were pretty much just, you know, enlisted guys making the most money we'd ever seen in our entire life. Yeah. And it was always a huge topic of conversation.
Yeah. That's one of the big things that I've heard from some of the folks that I know who've gone into contracting is they're just blown away by the amount of money that they're making. And they're like, I don't know where I would make this kind of money anywhere else. And so, that's the draw for them is the money, the greed, I suppose, you know, in your vernacular there with the book title. But
I don't pull punches in the book. I mean, that's all there is to it. Like I was there because I was greedy. I wanted the cash. I call myself a mercenary because I knew I was there for the cash grab. Now, other people take umbrage with that term and they say, oh, we worked for the State Department. We weren't mercenaries. Yeah. And you donated all your money to the kids orphanage in, right. You know, Uganda, right? Horse crap. You're there for the cash. So I'm probably the most transparent contractor that's ever come out to say, oh yeah, no, we were there for the money. We didn't give a crap.
Right. And you know, I don't look at it as a bad thing. I mean, greed has like a negative connotation to it. I don't look at it as a bad thing. I mean, you went out, you did a job. Someone said, hey, I'm willing to pay you X amount of money for doing this job. And you said, yes. So that's like a normal, employer employee relationship. Like if you weren't okay with that amount of money, you would say, no, I'm not going to do it. And then they'd go find someone else to do it. Or they'd realize, hey, it's too low and we got to increase this price. And hey, you know what? They got you, and you guys came to a mutually beneficial arrangement, and it all worked out. So, you know,
it benefited everybody but the people in Iraq.
Well, sure. I think I was looking at the employer-employee relationship there. Yeah, so the people, let's talk about the people in Iraq and, kind of maybe what could have gone better for them to make it so that it was a win-win-win situation.
Yeah, so let me I gotta delve into the history of it. So when we went into Iraq during the ground offensive, and I was there, we did not want to be seen as occupiers, right? That was the big thing, George W. Bush saying, we are not going there to occupy. So we set up the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority. Blackwater guys protected Paul Bremer. And that's really where Blackwater got started. Now, as soon as we had the opportunity as a nation, we gave Iraq back to an interim government. And we said, this is no longer a combat mission. This is now a diplomatic mission because you guys own your country. Now, once it became diplomatic, they started sending the CIA, the NSA, the State Department, USAID, you name it, all these guys over to help them build their nation. Mm-hmm. Because everybody that knew how to run a nation was a Ba'ath Party member, and all those guys got booted out. So that's where Blackwater came in. That's Blackwater's real origin story, is they needed people to protect diplomats. The security team that they had did not have any kind of combat experience. So who do you hire? You hire a bunch of knuckle draggers like me. Like, that's great. Now, the problem with it is that you have the DOD that's running combat operations, and you have the State Department that's trying to run diplomatic operations, and nary the two shall meet. And then you throw in civilians that aren't under the UCMJ, that aren't under the State Department banner, that don't have the same rules of engagement. I never got a rules of engagement lecture when I got there. So it was just pretty much get this guy from point A to point B. He's going to help them learn how to run an airport or garbage. Or we went to the stock exchange. It was literally people writing in chalk on chalkboards. These guys over there. You're going to teach them how to do this thing so they can build their nation. Now, in the process, with civilians on the battlefield, we created a lot of problems for the military because we didn't tell them where we were going. We didn't tell them what we were doing. We would run up on military convoys all the time. They would run up on us. We're the only ones in Suburbans. So at the end of the day, like, common sense predicates, please don't shoot the guys in Suburbans. But we would also run people off the road, and we would shoot at cars because car bombs were all the rage back then. We didn't have the same rules of engagement. And when you put that many civilians in a battle space trying to not play nice with the military, it just causes frustration. And the frustration ultimately is going to be borne by the people of Iraq. So even though we were there to help you build your country, help you figure out how to pick up trash within neighborhoods because nobody knew how to do that, at the same time, we were running roughshod over Baghdad. And the civilian population, this was told to me by somebody in Ramadi, the civilians looked at contractors as the terrorists and the military as their allies. And look, looking back on it, I don't really blame them. We just did whatever we wanted whenever we wanted.
Yeah, so there's really, they let you off the leash and you were able to do whatever you wanted for the most part. I mean, you're shooting at cars. And, you know, probably not a bad thing because they could have been suicide bombers. Maybe looking back, could things have been done differently? Yeah, sure. I'm sure there could have been different ways of going about doing things. Maybe ways of identifying you, you know, so that they knew, get out of this guy's way, otherwise you're going to get shot. Okay. You know, like people driving around in Humvees, they probably figured, okay, with a, you know, 50 cal on top, that one, you probably want to get out of the way. But, you know, a Suburban, I don't know, maybe it wasn't as obvious to them. But I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is there. But, you know, I know, you know, contractors like Blackwater, they've been involved in places all over the world. And, you know, they're continuing to be used, I'm sure, in places like Ukraine, you know, and the things that are going on over there. And, you know, there's all sorts of different places where these contractors will fit in. And I think just like in the military, you do an after action review and you look at what, you know, some things that went right, some things that went wrong, and then you try to get better from whatever that end result is that you come up with. And I think, you know, as you know, obviously the contractors are civilians and so they don't necessarily fall under the the DOD or anything like that, but it would be probably beneficial from the federal level to look at the use of contractors and what were some things that went right and what were some things that went wrong. And maybe we can say, hey, these are your rules that you have to now operate under. I think that might be, and maybe that's something that has happened, but I don't really know.
I'm not privy,
but you would think let's do something like that. And let's, we got a lot of pushback with companies like Blackwater, including Blackwater. A lot of things went wrong and ended up in the news, and a lot of people got pissed off at it, and probably rightfully so. But why not look at what went right and do more of that, and also what went wrong and try to do less of that, and maybe set some ground rules for use of these contractors in future conflicts,
So I'll tell you exactly why. So the military and private military contractors have had over 20 years to stop hiring PMCs and start hiring the people to protect diplomats, right? Like, mm-hmm. It has been a 20-year time span. You could probably get 2 or 3 people through the pipeline that you would actually be able to train to do these jobs. And these government agencies have decided consciously not to. That's why you have Blackwater in Iraq 04, then you have the 13-hour guys in Libya, you have contractors in Syria, Ukraine. They got contractors over in Gaza right now that are restricting Gazans from getting into, or Palestinians getting into Gaza, and they're U.S. military contractors. And the truth is that using contractors is a pretty natural thing, right? When you go to Walmart, they have contractors over Christmas because they have an influx of need for people to check people out. And then after Christmas, you get rid of them because you don't need them anymore. We never got to the get rid of them part. And the reason is, when a contractor dies overseas or gets hurt, it's just a contractor. But when you have a soldier over there and they die and they get hurt, that is going to be in the national news media for weeks. Mm-hmm. So using private military contractors allows the political class and all of the agencies that use them to say, we don't have boots on the ground. Oh yeah, by the way, we got these contractors, but we don't have boots on the ground. And that's why you're seeing almost an explosion of this industry. We had private military contractors moving kids from the U.S.-Mexico border into the United States. We had private military contractors on ground in Haiti moving migrants to Guantanamo Bay and then into the United States. The Gaza thing. The problem is that there's no legal, there's no definitive legal coverage for private military contractors. And I think that is an absolute value if I'm a politician, because then I can kind of say, oh, it wasn't the State Department, it was Blackwater. Nisser Square, that wasn't the State Department. That was that bad Blackwater. Or Triple Canopy, or MVM, or Southwest Keys, or any of these other places that lost 325,000 migrant children. It allows them to say, that wasn't DHS or HHS, that was these terrible contractors. So yeah. There's absolutely a reason why they haven't done that AAR. Kind of shocking, kind of sad, but at the end of the day, like, money talks.
Yeah, and the way you explained it kind of makes sense. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, you still want to make the best use of these people. These people still are Americans, for the most part. There's probably some non-Americans that get hired by these companies as well. But
yeah, it depends on the contract, but yeah.
Yeah, sure. And I would imagine when you're in Iraq, they looked at you as if you were Americans. I mean, you didn't have, the American flag on your uniform the way, an Army soldier might have the flag on their uniform, but you're still Americans and they still look at you as Americans. You're still a representative somehow of America, because just like the contractors that Walmart hires over, the Christmas time, I don't know the difference between the person who's there seasonally or the person who's there full time who'll be there in July too. I don't know the difference. I just look at them as they're just people here who are stocking the shelves and running the cash registers, or, you know, whatever it is that they do. Obviously, you're not wearing a uniform, so there is that difference. You're driving different vehicles, probably have different, you know, weapons and body armor and that type of thing. But at the same time, you're doing something along with Americans. You're protecting American diplomats. You're doing that type of work. So I don't know. To me, I would feel like, you know, I think we're in agreement here. It probably would be a good thing to do some sort of AAR, but, you know, to your point, there's no reason for them to, you know, in their mind anyways, but, you know,
well, but maybe, are we really Americans? No, I mean, look, we're absolutely Americans, but the problem is, with a private military contractor, I'll just give you an example. So we had a private military contractor that ended up dying in Iraq in April 2005, and he did not get on any plane for 10 days to get sent home. If you die as a U.S. military member, you are tier one cargo. You are going to be the first one off the ground. His poor wife had to call to a senator and say, my husband has been sitting in a morgue in Baghdad for 10 days and he keeps getting bumped and I can't even have my husband come home. You don't get to go to Arlington National Cemetery. You don't have, you know, the SGLI, the $450,000 payout if you die overseas. If you lose an arm, yeah, there's some medical coverage, but it's not the same as, you know, going and retiring as a military guy. So they're, and they've been created by us, but contractors are not U.S. soldiers by any stretch of the imagination. Right. And they're treated completely differently. And that's right. I mean, is that right or is it wrong? I don't know. The guys that got hung in Fallujah, they got dragged through the streets. George W. Bush said, you know, I'm not going to be the next president that has a Somalia, so we're going to send the Marines into Fallujah to take it over. So the Marines ended up taking Fallujah. Marines ended up dying, getting hurt, getting injured to take Fallujah. And maybe they would have taken it anyway, but they had to take Fallujah because you have civilians on the battlefield and nobody knew what they were doing, where they were going, and they ended up getting ambushed. So it's just this massive gray area, both legally and morally, where contractors, yes, we're Americans, but we're not, you know, we're not U.S. soldiers. Right. So it just makes it, don't makes go into private security. That's what I'm telling your listeners. Don't do it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, to some of those things that you brought up, you know, it's kind of eye-opening, right? Like if something did happen to you, you might be sitting in a morgue for days or, you know, weeks. Even, and, you know, you don't get any fresher sitting in a morgue, you know? So, you know, that's a shame. And I, you know, I make that joke and I know we kind of all get the dark humor that we kind of joke around about, but, you know, thinking about that person's family, like that's awful. You know, you want to be able to bury that person and, you know, grieve and have that time instead of like having to call senators and congressmen trying to figure out where the body is and, you know, how to get them back home. That, like, that's ridiculous. But, you know, talking about the coordination between the military and the private contractors and, the State Department and all these other departments that are out there, when it's almost like the pre 9/11 days when like the FBI and the CIA and all these other agencies, like they didn't talk to each other. They just kind of did their own thing. And like post 9/11, they're like, oh, that's probably a bad idea. We probably should talk to each other and share information a little bit more. Again, I think we've had another one of those moments where maybe it makes sense to share some information and pass that information along. But you know, I think that's, it's just, it's eye-opening actually, just hearing, you know, your side of the story and some of the things that go on over there. You know, it's, you hear, you know, the sound bites in the news and, you know, how much of that can you really believe these days? You know, but when you hear from someone who's actually there, you know, kind of makes a little bit more sense of like why certain people have some problems with private contractors and why they continue to be used, because politically it's a better option, you know?
Oh, it's a great option, but at the same time, I don't know. Look, let's set the PMCs aside. When you walked into the embassy, when I walked into the embassy in Baghdad, everybody had their own little area, military, CIA, NSA, DIA, whatever you want to be. And then none of those guys would communicate. So yeah, we all had the same radio frequencies, but it almost became a turf war, right? Where everybody wanted to be able to take credit for anything that went good. And then if something went bad, nobody would raise their hand. And you saw the same thing with the military, right? They had these big walled compounds, Camp Liberty, Camp Victory, all these things. And then the people that were out at the small joint security stations or the combat outposts, they were completely distanced from those individuals. Now, look, you can track those vehicles and where they're going, but at the end of the day, you still didn't have, even within the military, the structure to be able to say who's doing what and when, right? Mm-hmm. It's a great way to lose wars. I mean, I think we've proven that over the last Iraq and Afghanistan fiascos for 20-something years.
Yeah, we've certainly gotten good at that, unfortunately. it hurts to say, but, you know, it's true. We went over there thinking that this was going to be a slam dunk, and then decades later, we're still like scratching our head, like what went wrong, you know? Which makes me kind of wonder, like, were those AARs actually being done on the military side of things? Like, obviously we weren't doing everything right. Otherwise we would have been done with that war a long time ago. We had some improvements that could have been made along the way, and you know what those were, I don't know. But they certainly, I mean, the war certainly ended not the way we wanted it to. Especially those of us who were over there.
You called it a rip toe, and I don't remember what it stands for, but it's like transfer of authority was the toe apart. And the unit that you always took over for did everything wrong. And then you were going to come in and do everything right. And then as you were going out, somebody would come in and be like, well, why'd you do it this way? And like by then you're a year in and you're like, I'm exhausted. I don't even care. Like, I'm not going to fight you on why I did things the way we did. And then, like at Cop Cash, when I was there as an Army intelligence officer, one brigade commander said that he was going to do everything to build schools and parks and community stuff. And then the next guy comes in and says, well, I'm going to use all my money to work on security. Or I'm going to work. So even then, it became this territory thing where people thought they could do it better. And there still wasn't a strategy of like, what does victory look like? I mean, if you can define it, that would be awesome. Because I've been waiting 20 years to hear it.
Beats me. That's something I never really had a clear vision of either. It was just, you know, for me as an E5 going over to Afghanistan, it was go do your job, follow your orders, you know, go on the missions, go on patrols, do what you're supposed to do. And come back, and hopefully everybody still has all their arms and legs and still got a heartbeat. You know, that's kind of what we were doing, you know. And I don't, like, what was the grand scheme of things? What was the end game? I don't know. I don't know what victory would have looked like. And that seems like a pretty big question to have. Like if someone who is there can't define it, and I'm not even sure the top brass could define it. Like, if we had some of the generals who were in charge over there, I don't know that they could. I mean, they can come up with an answer for sure. Is it a good answer? Is it really what victory would have looked like? Who knows? But
we made a lot of progress. We made a lot of progress this last year.
Yeah, and as you were talking about the different units, like, you know, after a year, another unit comes in and takes over, and another unit a year later, and it keeps going in this vicious cycle. And it made me think about, you know, what was the last war that we really, like, had a decided victory in, and, you know, maybe, like, World War II, maybe? I don't
World
know.
War
like,
II, yeah.
I'm guessing. You know, the Desert Storm, probably, you know, we did some good stuff over there.
That only counts for the people that wear the hats.
I'm being nice.
No, I know.
Right? But yeah, I mean, like, World War II, I would definitely say, like, that's for sure, hands down, victory. But look at how we fought that war, where we sent guys over there, wherever over there was, whether it was Pacific or Europe or, you know, whatever, We sent them there, and they were basically there until either they died or the war was over. There was no 1 year cycle and let's come home, you know, or, you know, maybe they got wounded and they come home, you know, that type of thing too. But you go and you fight the war, and that way, whatever that general or that, you know, whoever that is in charge of that battalion or whatever, whatever their goals are, that's what they're going to go and do. And they're going to go accomplish that. And it's not going to be wishy-washy and change every year. They're just going to go and accomplish that mission. And when that mission's accomplished, okay, what else is left to do? Let's go accomplish the next mission. And they're just going to keep sending guys in and taking over territory and, you know, whatever. And those guys want to get home. So they're going to go fight. It's not like they have a clear end date in sight. Like, you know, when you get deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan, usually you knew it was about a year later, but give or take, you know, you might get extended, you know, for a little bit, but it wasn't like you're going to be there for 5 or 6 years. You know, like you knew pretty soon you're going to be coming home. And then another group is going to come in and replace you. I don't know. Maybe that's a better way to do it. I'm not saying I would enjoy that necessarily, but maybe that's the way it needs to be done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in World War II, what we did is we took land and we held it. Yeah. We did not do that in Iraq. We did not do that in Afghanistan. We held little tiny bases within a geography, and then we tried to wage war from there. And then if you get all the way down to that, like, E3, E4 level, right? Because I was there once. It really is like, wake up, grab your gun, go do this. Yeah. As a private military contractor, it was almost exactly the same. Like, if you would have told me how, if you would have said, oh, how does this fit into the war? I'd be like, hey, we got that guy to the Ministry of Interior and back, and he didn't die. And then we got to go swim and drink beer at the pool and make asses of ourselves. Right. So, we could probably talk about this for the next, you know, 8 or 9 years and still not get an answer out of it, but
right.
We're definitely not doing it right.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, I think that's, it's a shame, really, you know, with all the money and lives and resources and everything that we threw into this over the last, you know, however many years now, it's just crazy that, you know, it didn't turn out better, you know, with, you know, being like the most powerful country, most powerful military, we couldn't affect really any change. I mean, we did for a period of time, but then it all kind of went to shit. So, you know, it is what it is, at this point. But, you know, when you were transitioning, you kind of flip-flop back and forth between military and non-military. Any issues for you in, as far as transitioning? I mean, the roles were similar enough. I would imagine it might have been, you know, easy enough for you to transition. But were there any issues with you in that transition period?
You know, every time I transitioned, it was always looking for the next best option, right? Like, I think a lot of the times veterans kind of get stuck around what was my job in the military and what is my job now. For me, dude, when I got done with basic training in AIT, I started working at Sam's Club when I was going to college. Like, who cares? At least I'm doing something. I'm making some money. Then when I got activated, I got done. I was going back to college and then got activated again for, I don't know, like 4 months. So, dude, I transitioned 8 or 9 different times. Now, the hardest transition that I had was Blackwater by far, because there is no veterans resources for Blackwater guys. Yeah. And this was 05, right? PTSD hadn't even hit the vernacular of what was going on with people coming back from the wars. So that was exceptionally difficult. And the only thing that it did is make me want to keep going back. All my friends are in Iraq. I feel comfortable in Iraq. I have my little house in Iraq, even though it's just a bed and a TV and, you know, a pillow. But everything drew me back to that until finally I was like, okay, now it's big boy time. What do I want to do with my life? And then that's where the college degree came in. So any veteran that's having problems, just do the next best action. And then sooner or later, you'll look back and say, holy crap, that worked out. My criminal justice degree, I don't use it at all. I know, shocker. You guys are like, holy cow, this guy isn't using his criminal justice degree. But that degree got me to become an Army officer. And then when I started meeting the Army officer, which is the exact opposite of the enlisted corps. Here, I'll give you an example. The enlisted people are like, do it that way because that's how I was taught and it sucks and you have to suck too. The officer corps is like, hey, come on over here, man. I'll help you out. I'll show you what to do. Like they help each other. Mm-hmm. And I ended up meeting a guy that was like, hey, what are you going to do when you get out? And I said, I'm going to go get a sociology, master's in social work. And he's like, what the hell's wrong with you? You should be going to Harvard or Tufts or UChicago or any of these fancy schools that I didn't even know existed. And I took the right advice at the right time. So that's why how I got to Tufts University. And then when I got to Tufts, I got my business degree instead of getting an international security studies degree. And then the business degree translated to my first job, which got me my next. So I know it's difficult and it's really hard for people to sit there and say, the other side is over there. How do I get there? And the truth is, it's just one step at a time. Like, the richest people I know are plumbers and do concrete and like they own these small little companies. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're going to have to go out there and you're going to have to snake a drain and a turd might get in your mouth. That happens. But if you're running your own plumbing company in 5 years and you're making $200,000 a year, that turd doesn't taste so bad.
I like how you put that. You might be doing literally some shitty work, right? But again, to your point, you might be doing stuff that's actually really lucrative, and it might not be the sexiest position. It might not have this fancy title in a corner office. The things that I think, like when we were growing up, like that was what success looked like, right? But like these days, I mean, yeah, sure, if you have that. Nothing wrong with that. I'm not knocking that, but I know there's a plumber who lives in our neighborhood and he's like, I have more work coming in than I can handle. I can't do, I'm turning away jobs because I just have so much work, and he's bringing in tons of money. And at this point probably needs to hire people to grow his business and do bigger and better things, right? But I don't know exactly what he wants to do with his business, but still, to your point, there's a lot of options out there. And so doing that next best thing, take stock, take inventory, do a AAR of yourself, of your life at this point, and say, all right, what's going good? Okay, these things are going good for me. Great. What's going bad? What can I improve? Now, how do I improve those? What's that next best thing? Maybe it's a career. Maybe it's you need a education. Maybe you need to go to college. You might not need to go to college. Maybe you need to go to get some sort of other training or certificate or whatever the case may be. But to your point, you can use that GI Bill for a lot of training. And some people don't realize that the type of things that you can use it for. They sometimes think it's just for college. I had a guy on the podcast a while ago, he became a yoga instructor, by That's using awesome. His GI Bill, and it's like, people don't think of that, but you could. And so like, why not, get your training in, being a plumber or HVAC or whatever the, industry is that you're interested in, go do that thing and get some time in there. And then, maybe it's going back to school and getting your business degree and then starting a business and doing that and then hiring people and growing it from there. And you become this plumbing mogul or something. I don't know.
The Roto-Rooter guy. Yeah. I'll tell you what sucks. What sucks is taking accounting classes and finance classes and all these business classes. But I'll also tell you that the first time I took an accounting and finance class, I was able to do my taxes by myself and I got so much money back. And it's the same thing. Look, you don't have to, you can go our generation, right? If you got a college degree and you were our parents' generation, they would line up and people were hiring you. That's not how it works anymore, right? With the soft sciences, we don't need a bunch more psychology majors. I hate to be a butthole, but at the end of the day, sociology majors are not, they're going to work at Home Depot, and I've seen it happen. Mm-hmm. it's harder to go into engineering and business and all these things, but what it does is it gives you industry experience.
Yeah.
So if you've been an infantry guy or you drive a tank, people don't need infantry guys and people that drive a tank. But what they do need is people that understand accounting and finance and engineering. And it sucks to take those classes. I know, I've taken them. But at the end of the day, that's what's going to get you ahead of the of your peers. Because not only do you have your leadership experience, your military experience, you're a little bit older. Oh, and you have your accounting degree or your finance degree. That's where your sweet spot is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I have an accounting degree, which I, other than doing my own taxes, I don't use anymore either. And so, I can attest to the fact that, yes, taking the accounting classes does suck. But it, to your point also, it did provide me a lot of other benefits that I was able to take and then use in when I started my own business. And I understood the financial side of things. I had a business where I set it up that I really couldn't lose money unless I was stupid on, you know, certain expenses, but like I really didn't have to spend money until I made money. And so that was a nice thing, you know? And so, it made it so that the revenue side was always higher than the expense side. And that's just like a basic, simple accounting piece of the puzzle there. But like, if you can figure out a way to do that and it's, you're always getting the money in first before you're spending it and make sure that you're spending less than what you're getting in, you're never going to lose money. You know, and so it's, you know, just a simple example, but it, you know, it's something that sometimes I don't think people really think of that. They just say, oh yeah, cool. I got this great, you know, this great job. It's going to pay me X amount of money. And I got to go buy, you know, twice that amount of money of supplies in order to do that job. Well, that job is a shitty job. You shouldn't be doing that one.
Right. Well, that's funny because people ask me, I'm thinking about going overseas. And they told me that I would have to buy my own gear and my own weapons. And I was like, that is not the company that you want to work for.
Right.
That is a company that is going to hang you out to dry. So, it's very similar in the PMC world.
Yeah.
You and I geeking out about accounting and stuff. Everybody's like, oh, man. May as well just take an accounting class now.
But, yeah, right.
But if you take an accounting class and you decide to be a plumber, then you can do the accounting for your own. You don't have to pay somebody for it. Like there's just a lot of benefits for putting the suck up front.
Well, and to your point of what you were saying before, that the business degree or the engineering degree or things like that, those are things that will help you in other areas. So like a business degree, for example, I don't care what company you work for, it's a business. And so that business is going to need people who understand business because I don't care if it's a nonprofit, if it's a plumbing company, if it's an accounting, a CPA firm, or a painting company or whatever, I don't care. They all need people who understand business, people who understand the financial side, the people who understand the marketing side, the management side, all of the pieces of business that go into it. And so if you have a business degree, you're going to be marketable to almost any business out there because they're going to need people like you who understand the issues that they're going through. Engineering, you know, if you want to sell something that you're producing, you probably need some pretty good engineers to figure out how to produce this thing and how to do it effectively, how to make it better, you know, how to do it cost effectively. And, you know, those are important things. So yeah, going back to that education piece, I think is huge, because there's, you can learn how to be a plumber, just using that as an example. But if you don't know how to run a plumbing business, you're not going to be very successful. I'm not even successful at saying that word at running your own business if you don't understand that. Now, some people may just have a knack for it and then maybe they don't feel like they need the degree. Fine, great. But, you know, it I don't think it'll hurt, you know, either way. But, man, this conversation has gone kind of all over the place. We've gone from private contracting, we've gone to military, we've gone to education, and I kind of harped on it a little bit because I think it's important for people transitioning to realize that, you know, maybe their military career well, as good as it is, I'm not putting it down or knocking it. It may not just be enough for whatever that next step is. Maybe you do need to look into some additional education, whether it's college or a trade school or whatever it is. And that's fine. And when you do that little bit of suck up front, that's something you can take with you for the rest of your career, the rest of your life. And, you know, why not get it out of the way early, right?
Absolutely.
So, anything else that we didn't, I mean, we touched on a lot of topics here. Anything else that
we went
missed?
All over the place.
I know this was kind of like a buffet line. We could just pick whatever we wanted to chat about. But, you know, anything else that we missed that you, wanted to get across to the audience?
No, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I became a private military contractor because it fell into my lap and it was the next logical step. And I made a bunch of money at it. And I get these questions all the time on social media. How do I become a private military contractor? And the truth is, I'll give you my best advice. One, set a goal, right? Yeah. Whether that is, I want to have $100,000 in my bank after I pay my taxes, pay your taxes. Believe me, I've seen, oh, dude, it turns out so bad if you don't. Yeah. Or, hey, I want to have enough money to finish my college degree, or I want to pay off my house. Whatever that is, set that goal before you do it. And then what that allows you to do is say, do I want to keep doing this job or do I need to keep doing this job? I'll tell you my story. I went over there for 6 months, came home, bought a Land Rover, blew all my money. And then within a month, within literally 33 days, blew all what? I was there for 6 months, so I had $90,000 gone. Hmm. Gone. And then I had to go on my next contract. And that's what a lot of people get stuck into, that cycle. Yeah. Like, oh, I have to get my next contract because I bought a $8 million house instead of buying a $450,000 house. Or, oh, I really wanted that new Harley Davidson. And then you're back overseas being like, did I really want that Harley Davidson when mortars are getting ready to hit me?
Right.
So if you're going to go into this career field, and absolutely reach out, I'm happy to talk to you. But set a goal, and then that just gives you that freedom to say, do I want to keep doing this? Or do I have to keep doing this? And once you get into that want period, it is so much better. And I've met guys that are still doing it because they want to. I've also met guys that are doing it because they owe the IRS $350,000. So just, it is not, I've never looked at it as a long-term career path. Same thing with the military. I always looked at it as like a stepping stone. Yeah. But it is a wild world out there. It's not as wild as it was, you know, 04, 05. But the contracts keep getting bigger and crazier. Remember the Gaza floating dock? That was all private mm-hmm. military contractors because right. they didn't want to put boots on ground. Remember, that was the big thing, no boots on ground.
That's right.
Gaza, Syria, the Ukrainian war, they're moving closer and closer. You'll see it on X. You see these guys that are out there speaking perfect English on the front lines of the Ukrainian war. Those are private military contractors. So if anybody... We need to take a look at it, and senators, congressmen, all those people need to take a look at this and say, is this how we want to wage war going forward? Because that's where we're going. And it's only going to take a few private military contractors to get killed in Syria, Ukraine, or something, and it drags us into a war. And that's my biggest concern, is putting civilians on the battlefield and then them taking one step too far. Is that going to drag us into the next war? And I hope not, but man, we can't help ourselves.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we seem like we're always looking for that next war, unfortunately. And, you know, that's something, you know, as you know, the next generation gets older, like I don't want my kids to have to go to war. You know, if they choose to join the military, fine, that's on them. But I don't want it to be like a have to, a Vietnam draft era kind of thing. So let's try to, you know, be cool.
You know, just be cool.
Be cool. You know, don't step out of your lane, and things will be okay. But yeah, this has been a great conversation. I think, you know, like I said, we did cover a lot of bases here, but I think there it's an interesting topic, talking about the contracting and the things that may or may not have gone well over there. You know, the things that you know, people have talked about and that you've seen firsthand. Again, the book is Guns, Girls, and Greed, and I will put a link to the book in the show notes for the listeners so they can grab a copy of it, so they can, you know, see that firsthand account of, you know, what went on, you know, on the ground there. So,
well, let's caveat that it is a PG-16 book. Your fourth grader should not be doing a book report on this book.
Sure.
It is okay. Raw. It is unfiltered. It is exactly what war is at the ground level. I only mention that because my buddy loaned it out to his friend, and her fourth grade son got a hold of it and started doing a book report. And she had to go talk to the principal about, oh yeah, Morgan's talking about shooting cars and then more. Yeah. Like, don't, please God, don't give it to your kids. But if you get into dark humor and you want to know what it feels like to be that person on the ground in Iraq, like, this is the book for you.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes. Don't give it to your kids. Yeah. That, just use your head as a parent. Like, don't, like, I mean, just from the title, I probably wouldn't, you know,
you never know.
You never know. I mean, yes, I'm judging a book by its cover, but you know, but anyways, yeah, don't do that. Read it yourself first before you give it to your kids and make your own judgment. I'm not going to tell you what to do. You're a grown up. You can live your own life, but, yeah, so again, I'll have a link to the book in the show notes. Anywhere else that people can check you out or find out any more information?
Yeah, if you want to see, you know, me shake my butt, I'm on TikTok at BlackwaterDude and the number one at BlackwaterDude1. I'm also on Instagram and X with the same handle at BlackwaterDude1. So just...
Excellent.
Reach out. If I can help you, just reach out.
Excellent. And I'll put those links in the show notes as well, so people can watch you shaking it for whatever reason.
You would pay $10. I'm just saying.
I wouldn't, but someone might. I don't know. All right. Thanks so much, Morgan.
Take it easy.